All right, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming back, those of you who have. We're going to move on in a way from yesterday's session that we did, to look a bit more specifically at the subject of rhetoric. I know certainly at Stratford sometimes we introduce this subject and you can see the actors' faces falling a bit as if rhetoric is far too kind of academic a subject to really engage an actor's emotional sensibilities. But really, very essentially, rhetoric is just the art of persuading people through language. And Shakespeare knew a lot about it. So we're going to do a little exercise to explore rhetoric, but also try and find out how Shakespeare puts clues about character into the text. And we're going to see if we can pull those ideas out a bit in order to identify that. So I have my lovely assistants here at front row, and we're going to look at a piece. So before we do that, I'd like to introduce a gentleman here. This is Sam Leith, and Sam is here because he's written the book that I've been looking for a long time, and here it is. Sam Leith, You're Talking to Me, which I guess is how you say it. And it's rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. And he puts it in a really very vivid, very colourful, and very, very funny way. And it's really all the things we'll be talking about today, he distills in this book. So if you want to know more at the end of the session, then go order your copy. There you are. I get my cut.
Thank you. Yeah.
So what we're going to do is look at the beginning of a particular Shakespeare play, a very early Shakespeare play, and it's the opening of Titus Andronicus. Now, don't tell me you know Titus Andronicus really well, because I'll be really disappointed. Who knows Titus Andronicus? Who's ever seen Titus Andronicus on stage? Okay, very good. Right. Pretend you never saw it. No, don't have any clue about what it's about. Can we hand out those pieces of paper? So hand them out to the actors first, if you would, and then to anybody else who wants them. Again, like the opening of Romeo and Juliet, you know nothing about these characters before this point. This is the very opening of the play, so you know nothing about either character. These are the first two speeches of the play, just as the prologue is the first speech of Romeo and Juliet. So we're going to explore the text, what it means, and then how the two speeches are written and what that might tell us about those two characters. So if we can start off, can everybody, all the actors, come out here? Now, we're going to split. So how many have we got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So around about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, around about rope there. That's advertising, presumably. This you lot are Saturninus. You lot are Bassianus. Say Bassianus.
Bassianus.
Yeah, it's Bassianus and Saturninus.
Saturninus.
Okay, so Saturninus, can you give us your speech first, and then Bassianus, can you give us yours?
Shine, and Romans, fight for freedom in
Very good. The word is obviously desert rather than desert. But then you are at Oxford University. all right. Delivered like that. A bit bland. A bit boring, no doubt. But that's inevitable when we're speaking in unison. But any sense of what the two speeches are about? Any sense of what's... that's you've delivered it, and we've heard it for the first time. The audience in the theatre gets as that much to understand what the two characters are. But give me a sense of what's happening. What's happening?
Is yeah. Saturninus appealing to be made emperor?
Saturninus, indeed, is appealing to be made emperor. Okay, anybody else? What else is happening?
They're trying to get the people on their side.
They're both trying to get the people on their side, yes. Yeah. So what is it, in other words? It's a, yes?
It's a political party.
It's like a political party. It's like an election, isn't it, in essence? What do we pick up anything about Saturninus as opposed to Bassianus?
Are they both sons?
Both sons, indeed. Okay. Let's now just unpick it. Let's take Saturninus first of all. Say the first line, put it into your own words, and carry on. So say the line as it is in the Shakespeare, and then put it into your own words.
Oh God! noble patrician, patient for my right.
Meaning.
Okay,
patricians. Anybody patricians? Yeah. Basically aristocrats. Yeah. So they're the posh knobs.
Okay,
so noble posh knobs. People, yes, patrons of my right, people who, support my right to be emperor. Yeah, good.
Defend the justice of my cause with arms.
Meaning.
So support me with weapons because I'm right.
Support me with weapons because I'm right. Yeah, okay, next slide.
And countrymen, my loving followers, in the same country as me, loyally follow me.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, that's pretty clear, isn't it?
Plead my successive title with your swords. So defend my right to the title with weapons.
Okay, so what's the difference between your two lines and your two lines?
And this one is saying it's just simply right that I am the
emperor.
It's my
right.
He's addressing two different sets of people. He's saying posh knobs and the rest of you. Maybe because he's thought posh knobs are up for me, but I better appeal to the rest of you as well. We'll see. Next line. And just give us the next line too.
Where the imperial diadem of Rome.
Meaning what?
I'm the first son of the last person to rule, therefore presumably yeah. I have the right to it.
Yeah, so if we're in a system of primogeniture, where eldest son automatically gets the crown, then it's my right to have it. Next line.
Then let my father's honours live in me.
Meaning? Yes.
Of which I've implied we'll back up as swords. We won't have to if you let my father's arms live on me.
Okay, great. And last line.
Nor wrong mine age with this indignity. Not exactly sure
okay.
What age means in this context.
Help out your partner there. Mm-hmm. Rope.
It could be, I suppose it could be an age as in like an age
an
of
era.
Time and era.
Yeah.
Or it could be his personal, like, because he's already said, okay, so I'm asked to take on board my father's honours, but also bear in mind my own honour, my own status, you know. Do this for him and do it for me. yeah, I guess it could be either. I'm not sure which of those two.
If he said he's...
Did he endure the indignity of not winning this election?
Yes, so what is the indignity?
That he would not be allowed to follow his father.
And so in terms of the age, if he's the firstborn son, what might the age refer to? He's the eldest. No wrong mine age as firstborn with this indignity. Great, okay, we'll park that for a second. Let's have Bassianus then.
Romans.
Yes, yeah, okay. Different to the people he's just appealed to.
It's more inclusive.
It's everybody, isn't it? Essentially. Yeah, next line.
If ever Bassianus sees his son.
Yes, meaning?
he's referring to him as the kind of son and equal.
Yes, of, he is, so I was Caesar's son too.
What were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome.
Meaning?
So was honourable to all of you lot who live in the country that I live in.
Yes, yes. Gracious in the eyes of royal Rome. Yes. What about the word gracious?
well, I suppose partly honourable, but partly sort of thankful for what he's received. And there's a sort of very personal connection with the people there. As
yeah.
As opposed to just, I am superior.
Yeah.
And you shall make me emperor.
Yeah. I mean, grace is a grace in Christian terms is the gift of the bounty of God. So it's a sort of it's a very unaggressive word, isn't it? It's not saying we're honourable in the eyes of royal Rome. We're gracious in the eyes of royal Rome. Has something interesting to it. Next line.
Keep then this passage from the capital.
Meaning.
So it's like defend like my, as he was able to defend my right. Like it's saying defend my right to power.
And what's the capital? Just so we got that clear. It's the seat of power, isn't it? Yeah. It's and indeed, when America took on the imperial, the Roman form of governance in a way, as opposed to British monarchical systems, they had a capital and a senate and all the rest of it. So the capital is the seat of power. So keep this passage to the capital, keep this way to the capital clear. Yes, next line.
And suffer not dishonor to approach.
And give me the next line as well, and then we can do them together. Give me the next line.
The imperial seat to virtue consecrate.
So what does that mean between the two of you?
So don't be mean to me because I'm trying to be emperor.
Okay, don't let dishonor approach the imperial seat.
So actually don't dishonor the entire kind of frame of governance, like the actual authority of Rome itself, rather than just me.
By doing what?
Letting my brother
yeah.
be emperor.
Yeah. Don't let him disgrace the imperial seat.
And so cut down virtue.
Yeah, which is, so let's have the next line.
To virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility.
Meaning?
You know my better character.
Yeah.
Let that stand for itself.
Yeah. So it's the imperial seat that's consecrated to virtue, isn't it? What about, okay, we know what virtue is, but we think. Virtue, what about the word continence? What do we understand the word continence to mean? Ability, mm-hmm.
Control.
Yeah, it's kind of self-restraint, isn't it? If a continent is bound by borders, when you are incontinent, you burst those borders in one way or another, and so continence is a sense of self-restraint. So, the imperial seat is dedicated to continence and virtue, continence. What else is it consecrated to?
Nobility and justice.
Nobility and justice. Okay, great.
But let desert in pure election shine.
Very good. Meaning?
But let sort of what is naturally deserved be voted for.
Be voted for, yeah. And what? Give me the last line.
And Romans fight for freedom in your choice.
Meaning?
Meaning on the surface you have, you know, make sure you have the power to choose freely.
Yeah.
The implication being that you will choose for me when you have the power to do that.
Okay, so now we're in ancient Rome and therefore presumably at this point the son ought to succeed the father, and Bassianus, albeit a son, is suggesting a different form of governance, isn't he? And if you think of that in ancient Roman terms, that's one thing. If you think of this as an Elizabethan play, then you're thinking of something much more radical, really. We kind of go, yeah, fight for freedom in your choice, that seems right to us, you know, democracy seems right, but it's not the prevailing form of governance in this position. So that makes these two speeches quite interesting. What we're going to look at is how, who's most effective. At a first go, if you now had to, this was an election and you had to choose one of them, who are you going to choose?
Bassianus.
You're all going to choose Bassianus? Yeah. Let's ask the audience. You're not going to choose Bassianus?
I was just going to say, if I was a nobleman, I'd probably use...
Ah. Let's ask the audience. Who is going to vote on the strength of that one reading for Saturninus? Very good. Okay. Two people. Very good. So we have two Saturninans, and are the rest of us
Bassianians, or are we abstaining? Put your hand up for Bassianus. Okay, let's see if we can change that. I want one Saturninus, and I want one Bassianus. You guys are the supporters of Saturninus, if you're not Saturninus himself. You guys are the supporters of Bassianus, and therefore will support Bassianus and heckle Saturnites. Let's have... Can you grab that chair and put it over there? And we'll have some side here. Right. Somebody be Saturnites, somebody be Bassianus on there, and somebody be Saturnites on there. Good. Okay, yes. Straight in there, yes! Right, I know you're standing on the chair. Apologies to... you're Saturninus, and you're Bassianus. And the rest of you can gather around them, and they're on the stump. And this is an election. You can choose. You don't have to get around the person you're supporting. You can get around and heckle the other person. Either heckle, or you will cheer on your supporter, and let's see how both speeches fare. Right, off you go.
Noble patrician.
Say was most, if you can hear above yourselves, Ken, who was the most effective on the stump, as it were? Bassianus. Are all the Saturninians agreeing? Bassianus, why?
Because there were more lulls during ours.
During his?
It seemed as though Bastian was using more like lists of threes to try to get a climactic kind of like rallying.
He's also incredibly impersonal compared with Saturninus being fight for me and I want to be ruler and Saturn make the rightful person.
Good. Okay. All right. We're going to try another exercise. Two different candidates. So I need a Saturninus and a Bassianus. We're starting with Bassianus. Oops, sorry, over there. You can sit in front here, guys. Just sit on the floor or sit on the chairs. This is the party political broadcast on behalf of the Saturninian party. You have to give it to camera. There is the camera. Saturninus. Let's see how you fare in front of a camera. Ready, and 5, 4, 3, 2.
Noble patricians, patrons of my right, defend the justice of my cause with arms. And countrymen, my loving followers, plead my successive title with your swords. I am his firstborn son that was the last to wear the imperial diadem of Rome. Then let my father's honors live in me, nor wrong mine age with this indignity.
Okay, persuasive. Let's have a Bassianus. Here we go. A part political broadcast on behalf of the Bassianus party.
Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right, if ever Bassianus, Caesar's son, were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome, keep then this passage to the capital, and suffer not dishonor to approach the imperial seat, to virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility. But let desert in pure election shine, and, Romans, fight for freedom in your choice.
You know, you hadn't until that final gesture. who was most effective on telly? Saturninus. Why?
It seemed more formal, and it seemed more appropriate for that kind of setting.
Mm-hmm.
There's also more of a personal connection. The extent to which Saturninus naturally talks about himself a lot more, draws the audience member in on a personal basis with member, rather than, you know, the rabble rousing.
Bassianus was in need that people around him to kind of give his cause strength.
But was the delivery a kind of counter to the message with Saturninus?
Yes, in that the aggression is lost, I think, the television.
And therefore, is it effective? No. Would you, at the end of that, go out, get your swords, and fight for him?
I think it's just jarring in a modern context, because, like, you wouldn't expect to see someone on TV saying, well, vote for me just because I'm me.
So the language isn't appropriate.
The quality of Bassianus' speech are more appealing to a TV audience.
Yeah.
It's more of an upstart, Bassianus, in that circumstance, because whereas Saturninus has, he is born first child, it's the whole rabble rousing, you've got to kind of get a, sort of an army behind you in order to support your cause as an upstart, whereas it seems to be more top down.
Exactly, it's all about authority, and whenever you're sitting in a TV situation, you have this kind of authority behind you, and that kind of it sort of fit in that sense, I guess.
What's weird about it, though, is the extent that Saturninus is asking people to draw their swords. Like, it almost seems, at least on first glance, it almost seems like he's on the back foot to start out with.
Saturninus.
Yeah, that he's like, okay, this isn't supposed to happen. Everybody get your swords out so we can make sure this definitely doesn't happen.
And that's the thing, is he's not asking them, he's instructing them. It's defend and plead, whereas there's an if and a then.
Yes. Okay, let's try this exercise. Can you all get up? Just the Saturninus first. Just the Saturninus. Now, what I want you to do is I want you to walk, as you say it, and stop for 2 seconds when you get to a full stop. And then carry on. Okay, just walking around the space.
Noble patricians, patrons of my right, defend the justice of my cause with arms. And countrymen, my loving followers, plead my successive title with your swords. I am his firstborn son, that was the last of wear the imperial diadem of Rome. Then let my father's honours live in me, nor wrong mine age with this indignity.
Good. Can the Bassianus do the same thing, and only stop when you get to a full stop? Don't look for the full stop, just do it.
Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right, if ever Bassianus, Caesar's son, were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome, keep then this passage to the capital, and suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, to virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility, but let deserved in pure election shine, and Romans, fight for freedom in your choice.
What did you notice? It's one sentence. First one is broken up into several sections, and therefore several cue points for heckling. There are quite a lot of points when, if we were doing the first exercise again, and you only were allowed to heckle when he came to a point of pause, then you would be able to heckle Saturninus a great deal more than you could heckle Bassianus. But there's also something about the structure of his argument, Bassianus' argument, that goes over one sentence, whereas Saturninus' argument is split up into several things. Bassianus, sit down. Let me have a Saturninus. Give me a Saturninus. You can give me a Saturninus. You've got one. There you go. I want you to... just have a Bassianus next to him. A nice Bassianus next to him, please. I want you to, whenever, don't read it, just watch it. Whenever Saturninus says, I, me, mine, anything that refers directly to himself like that, I, me, mine, I, repeat the word, shout it out. And then we'll do the same with Bassianus. Here we go.
Noble patricians, patrons of
my
I,
defend the justice of
my
with arms. and countrymen, my followers, plead my successive title with your swords. I am his firstborn that was the last to wear the imperial diadem of Rome. Then let my honours live in me, nor wrong my name in this indignity.
Good, next one.
Romans, friends, followers, favours of my right, if ever Bassianus, Caesar's son, were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome, keep then this passage to the capital, and suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, to virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility, but let desert in pure election shine, and Romans fight for freedom in your choice.
What do we derive from that little exercise?
He deliberately refers to himself in the third person as well.
And he goes, me. I mean, he never stopped saying me. And that's an interesting element. And Sam, I guess, referring to you at this point, that comes to one of our, what you delightfully in the book call the three musketeers of rhetoric.
Ah, yes, my musketeers. leaps onto stage. When you're talking about rhetoric, and this is kind of really the core of, I suppose, what I'm here to say, is that rhetoric, you know, as Greg rightly said, rhetoric is persuasive speech. But ever since Aristotle, there's been this body of knowledge that says persuasive speech isn't accidental, that what makes it persuasive. Aristotle said that rhetoric is a techne, which is at the root of the words technical and technique, which means it's something, it's nature improved by art. You can learn it, you can practice it, you can figure out how it actually works and break it down and kind of, as it were, look under the bonnet. And this body of knowledge, which has largely, you know, I lament because my book would have sold a lot more if it hadn't been, has been lost in the modern age pretty much. I mean, it's become an academic specialism. But in Shakespeare's day, it was taught in school. It was one third of an education. The trivium, I don't know whether you're familiar with that phrase, with grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And those three things were what, you know, that was what was taught in school, was taught in grammar school. That's what Shakespeare would have learned. And there's a huge amount of, you know, I mean, the study of rhetoric, formal rhetoric, takes in practically every twist and turn that language can take. It was what we had before literary criticism, it was what we had before linguistics. And in Shakespeare's day, the study of rhetoric as persuasive speech would not have been, there wouldn't have been a kind of distinction necessarily between formal rhetoric as speech making and rhetoric as acting. I mean, the Greek word for delivery as an act, the delivery of a speech, hypocrisis, is the same as the word for acting. And the first thing, just I want to say, which is where, to come back to where Greg brought me in, is that Aristotle said there were these three musketeers, and there are only three different persuasive appeals that appear in any piece of persuasive language, and they are ethos, pathos, and logos. And that's the sort of prism, these three kind of atomic particles, if you like, three elements of rhetoric, through which you can analyse all persuasive language. And ethos, which is absolutely the kind of bedrock of it, and that's what we're talking about when talking about how he, you know, friends, the Romans, friends, followers, or, you know, me, is how you position yourself with your audience as a speaker. So the ethos appeal is, you know, are you speaking the audience's language? Are you trustworthy? Are you presenting yourself as someone whose interests are identical with that of the audience? So when you get Saturninus, he's clearly interested in himself and his power. Bassianus is able to present himself as saying, you know, actually, I'm interested in your choice, in your power, in the, you know, disinterestedly, in the virtue consecrate in the state. That's ethos, and that's absolutely foundational. And always when you're looking at a speech, see how the speaker is positioning himself, how he's presenting himself. Then there's pathos, which you'll be familiar with that from, you know, film critics. Pathos is when Macaulay Culkin gets stung to death by bees or whatever. Actually, pathos encompasses a lot more than just that. It's not just the sad bit. Pathos is any appeal to the emotions, and that can include the appeal to patriotism you're seeing there. It can include the attempt to make an audience angry, which you see in Saturninus, a sort of slightly unsuccessful pathos appeal. And last of the musketeers, and very much least, unfortunately, is logos, which is the actual structure of the argument. And generally, you know, as you'll see again and again, who the speaker is, how they're saying it, and how they sway the audience's emotion can be far more important in the end than the actual, you know, logical structure of the argument. But again, there are formal arguments in here as well. So, you know, plead my successive title. You know, that's he's appealing to, you know, as a sort of a historical conservative idea of primogeniture. But of course, the fact that successive is pretty much the weakest triplet of syllables in that whole sentence, you know, that line. Successive, which is the nub of his argument, is kind of buried in the noise of it. So, you know, there's his logos vanishing from sight. So there you are, ethos, pathos, and logos. If you, you know, hold them close, they'll do you good over the years.
Brilliant, thank you. There's lovely descriptions of ethos, particular in Sam's book, one of which is, it's the Ich bin ein Berliner statement of kind of going, I am one of you. I am here, I've come to Berlin, I am one of you. Or when it fails, when the story that is put about, though is probably not true, of Peter Mandelson in his constituency, it's not Sunderland, is it? Where is it?
Hartlepool.
Hartlepool. Are you from Hartlepool? No. Going to a chip shop to show just what a man of the people and the Northeast he was, pointing to the mushy peas and says, I'll have some of the guacamole. Bang goes his appeal to ethos. I think that's really interesting in terms of this speech. So let's just examine Saturninus and Bassianus on those, just from your points of view. So in terms of where Saturninus puts himself, how successful is he in persuading you of the audience he's talking to and positioning himself in a position that you would vote for him, as it were? Any thoughts?
In terms of ethos, then it's very divisive. He's putting himself, setting himself as an authority figure,
yeah,
doing so in a way to suggest that that's why you should vote for him. He's portraying that as a positive quality, that he is above his audience.
Yeah, that's true. Just notice one very interesting thing. Yesterday we were doing the thing of beating out the iambic. So the iambic pentameter is basically de-dum, 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 de-dum. And where that collides, as it were, with the sense of the line, it can be entirely irregular or it can be irregular, and the irregularities point out the interest. So yesterday we were noticing that the second line of him, the chorus from Romeo and Juliet, in fair Verona where we lay our scene, is a regular line. The verse stress coincides with the sense stress, if you like. So, but the first line, two households, both alike in dignity, grabs you with the first word, it suggests the word that's most important to the whole play. Let's beat out the first line of each of these speeches. So say, didum, 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 didum five times, and then say the line in that didum rhythm, okay? Everybody follow what I'm saying? Here we go. Didum,
didum, didum, didum, didum. Noble
positions, patrons are my right. There you go. Noble. You know, nobody's going to say noble positions, patrons are. So, noble, okay? So the word that that Shakespeare is pointing you to stress in that line is what?
Noble.
And that gets you very clearly right at the top, Saturninus's, where his audience is. Do the same exercise with Bassianus. First line, here we go. Didum.
Didum, 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 didum. Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right.
Yeah, total bollocks up, yeah. Romans, friends, followers, favour. What do you notice more than anything about that line in terms of a 10-beat line? It's got too many syllables, it's a 12-beat line, depending on how you say those words. Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right. It could even be longer than that. What's that? Therefore, Shakespeare's doing that deliberately. You know, true ease in writing comes from art, not chance, as those move easiest who have learned to dance. Applies to acting too, Alexander Pope's essay on criticism. So it's deliberate. Shakespeare's done that deliberately. What's the impact of those two first lines from a rhythmical point of view?
I suppose Bassianus just isn't as well educated in how to get people to do what he wants to do, because he's not the firstborn son, he hasn't needed to do this, whereas Saturninus is much more formulaic and kind of well considered. It's just that he hasn't got any idea what the people might want.
Interesting.
So having so many syllables in the Bassianus first line means that it slows it down and kind of gives him an air of gravitas without kind of trying to grab it from him in the way that Saturninus
It is in the fact that he's a one variation, the Saturninus is a one variation, and then you've got another variation which is actually relatively rare, having a hecatombe syllable line. So it's almost a childish, I'm going to one up my brother, see if that works or not.
Go on.
Well, he starts with Romans, which is, as someone else said, incredibly important. And then, and again, you've got the stress on the R. But it's almost like all of those words have almost equal stress. They're all so, like, kind of weighty in the way that they're said. Mm-hmm. And it's Romans are also friends, are also followers, are also favorers.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has this
okay.
You were talking about yesterday about the certain words. You have to say slowly.
Yeah.
You have to say these words slowly.
So,
and it gives
so
the weight
this, the interesting thing here is we have a sort of slight this disjunction here, don't we? Is that because he's not as good as rhetoric, or is it that he's better at rhetoric?
I think he's better. But
Romans, after all, is like noble. It's not Romans. It's Romans, which is at least a spondee, which is two heavy stresses, if not just inverting the iambic. Yes, go on.
It's kind of breaking the structure that Saturninus is really rigidly into. He's opening it out, saying, actually, this doesn't have to be exclusive to only my noble friends. I'm opening this out as I'm opening out the iambic to all of you.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're saying, it kind of slows it down. It's kind of saying, well, I'm not just noble. And because it's so long, he's kind of added in all these other people. It really emphasizes that he's breaking the norms. And
okay, good. What about this alliteration? What about, like, from forth the fatal loins of these two foes yesterday? What's the effect of the Fs in that first line of Bassianus?
Seems to, like, bind everything together.
Yeah.
So, like, as you were saying, like, that equal stress, like, that's kind of how things are equated, how the relationships are equated within that line through the alliteration.
Yeah.
That sort of fricative sound with the F compared to the plosive alliteration in the first line.
I agree. Look at those P's in the first line of Saturninus. Noble patricians, patrons of my right. And look at the F's in Bassianus, which are much more, I would say he's stroking the audience.
Yeah.
He's going, Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right. It's very unlike the use of the alliteration of F's in from forth the fatal loins of these two foes, but take the last line of Bassianus and look what he does with alliteration there. Somebody say it.
Romans, fight for freedom in your choice.
There you go. Same alliteration, same letter, fight for freedom in your choice, but completely different effects to followers, favourers of my right. Which is interesting, isn't it?
In some ways, it's as if the opening two lines from Saturninus ask for movement with arms, and obviously Bassianus goes on to ask for movement kind of by vote with election.
Yep.
And the softness of the F's compared to the slightly harsher P's kind of seem to echo that difference of approach.
Yep.
One is asking for one, a kind of softer approach to governance, and the other a much harsher one.
Yep.
So I think he's kind of bringing out through sound his argument.
Yeah, I think if you're listening to the sound of the two speeches, the first is much more aggressive than the second. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Yes, you can say.
The friends, followers, favorites, all this kind of rule of three going on. There's something kind of building on it as it becomes friends, your followers, your favorites, as the script was saying. But the fact that it's kind of breaking the iambic structure, it's like he's almost pretending to be bad at rhetoric. Well, actually also being really, really, really good at it.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? It's a bit like it's kind of disarming. You were probably not born but at this point, but there was when John Major was fighting an election, and he suddenly decided to do, on the campaign trail, to do sort of kind of very open conversations with his audience. And he took off his jacket and put it on the back of a chair. And the papers were full of what that was the following day. But clearly what he was doing was going, trying to soften the as it were, the approach of the Conservative Party as being, you know, tough, and suggesting that actually he was just a man of the people, you know? Suggesting that he really did know the difference between mushy peas and guacamole.
I was going to say, this is a point which I should like to say, never trust people when they're doing this. The anti-rhetoric thing, I mean, there was one, almost as long as the history of rhetoric, in fact, I think possibly even longer, is the history of mistrusting it. And Plato, you know, it starts with Plato. Plato hated rhetoric. He thought that democracy is a very bad idea, and that rhetoric as the tool of democracy was a very bad idea. And so throughout history, and you'll have seen it very strongly in, you know, the opposition to Barack Obama, this thing that, you know, oh, he's just a person of words, don't trust him. But bear in mind, Obama's opponents didn't start campaigning in interpretive dance. They continued to make speeches, they just didn't make them as well as Obama. And so when you get Mark Antony saying in Julius Caesar, you know, I am no orator as Brutus is, but as you know me, all a plain blunt man. Whenever someone tells you they're not doing rhetoric, they're lying. And that is a rhetorical appeal in itself. You know, rhetoric is kind of inescapable. So this whole business of, you know, I don't really know how to speak, I'm just kind of, just, you know, I speak from the heart. That guy, he's doing rhetoric, I speak from the heart. The person who's speaking from the heart, he's the one who'll steal your silver spoons. So, you know, be warned.
With that health warning on Bassianus' speech, of course, the point is, we refer often to rhetoric as mere rhetoric or empty rhetoric, because there's a distrust of rhetoric. But if you can get away without them thinking it is rhetoric, genuinely manage to do that, then the effect is better, isn't it? Because we despise art that has a palpable design upon us. If we think we're being manipulated, then we distrust it. I am afraid I'm not a great fan of musicals, because I know that when they, you know, the chord goes up and the key change happens in Les Miserables, I'm kind of going, yes, I'll march to the barricades. And I know that I resist it, but I know that it's I knew they just did a key change. Why am I starting to cry? And I think rhetoric has the same kind of thing, that there's a built-in crescendo, which there's probably also some very clever words for what that crescendo is, but in terms of the disposition of the argument, in terms of how the argument is put together, Bassianus has clearly got the better use of rhetoric.
He also will, I mean, there's a climax is what they call sort of crescendo in rhetorical terms. There's this rhetoric does come with Barnacle with these fantastic kind of inkhorn Latin and Greek terms. I mean, climax is a word we actually know, but you know, it's full of things like anti-metaboly, which are great. It builds, but also it recapitulates. I mean, as you know, you pointed out, there's that Romans, friends, followers, favourites, am I right? The sound pattern of that is exactly mimicked with the Romans fight for freedom in the last one.
Yes.
And also, within the same sentence, he said Romans again. So he's re-established, you know, sort of underlined his ethos appeal, because he's like, he's interpolated his audience. He said, this is who you are. I'm appealing to you as Romans, as one. And he reminds you within the same sentence that, you know, it's an additional kind of vocative that you don't really need. And Romans, you know, just reminding them who they are. So, you know, that circles, that speech, absolutely ties it up with a bow. And, of course, Saturninus he sort of blethers off about...
He doesn't get... It's a very interesting thing, isn't it? If you look at them... tell me, if you were... Again, in modern terms, if you were... supporting the Saturninus Party, and you were their party chairman, and you were trying to organise the campaign. What is the slogan you put on the banners for the Saturninus Party? Direct from the speech. You've got to choose some line or some words from the speech to put on the banner. Plead my successive title with your swords. Yes, that's catchy, isn't it?
One, two, right, get up.
Very much better put, but take it from the text. Where is he? What is on his banner? I think I'm vaguely probably yes.
Defend the justice of the people.
Yeah, pithy. Anybody else?
Let my father's living. Yeah. On a living.
Yeah. Either way, in terms of sound bites, they're not very successful, are they? What in Bassianus, what goes on the slogan? When they get to the climax, what suddenly gets blasted out behind him on the telescreen there? Absolutely perfect. And it's backed up with some pithy alliteration and memorability. Because that's another element of rhetoric, isn't it? The memorability of how you put the phrase.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why. I mean, one of the reasons why a couple of you have already mentioned the rule of three. One of the rhetorical figures that's best known and most overused is the tricolon, because for some reason we naturally remember things. And when I was researching my book, I tried to find out whether there was some fancy neurological explanation for it, and failed. But it just seems to be a fact that the human brain remembers things very well in groups of three, and it remembers them even better if they alliterate, and it remembers them even better if they, have a nice rhythmic quality to them as well. So, I mean, when Churchill is remembered for saying blood, sweat, and tears, he actually said blood, sweat, toil, and tears, but it's been misremembered it because there's more in, blood, sweat, and tears. They're the three bodily fluids. And they're a tricolon. So you find, there we are, to justice, continence, and nobility. There's a group,
So he's actually structured that, because he says to virtue consecrate, to justice, continence, and nobility.
Yes.
If he said to consecrate, to virtue, justice, continence, and nobility, it wouldn't have been so successful, you say?
Precisely. I think that's, he sort of tacks on the tricolon after that. But, a lot of, the things, if you look at a kind of memorable soundbite, you'll often find there's a piece of either alliteration or repetition or some form of sort of wordplay in them. I mean, I mentioned antimetabolia earlier, or chiasmus it's also called, which is that what American speechwriters call the reversible raincoat, which is when it's asked not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It's the ABBA format. There isn't one of those in here, but there are, Bassianus, he's got, there's an antithesis, which is another sort of rhetorical term, he balances two terms. So he says, suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, but let desert and pure election shine. And I don't think it's an accident that desert and dishonour alliterate across those lines. Saturninus, much less neatly, has these clumsy, he has a sort of parallelism instead. I mean, his master figure there is, noble patricians defend the cause of justice, countrymen, plead my successive title with your swords. And I think that sort of repetition can be powerful if it works at a granular linguistic level, but actually it's weakened there because there's nothing musically, there's nothing in the sound of it that puts those parallels together, those two phrases together. Rather, arms and swords, you end up with a sort of mush of two terms that are paralleling each other, but not, they don't add, they don't reinforce each other, they seem to kind of fall apart. So, that's exactly where memorability is really important. If it's not patterned properly at a linguistic level or even at a sonic level, it will, slide off the brain. Yeah.
What do we think of Saturninus's climax? We talked about Bassianus's climax, but what about Saturninus?
Well, that line would never go on the poster.
No.
That's dead, maybe for Cynthia, but not that one.
Yeah, and actually, it's not the manifesto at the end, it's the gripe, isn't it?
It's very negative.
It's negative.
And indignity.
And what a pathetic rhyming couplet that is. Let my father's honours live in me, nor wrong mine age with this indignity. Well, he is trying, isn't he? But he's not succeeding, I guess. Very good. Anything else that anybody's spotted about the two things?
I think someone kind of mentioned it before, but is the parallel construction of the first two lines. They both end of my right, and they both begin with that first, the spondi, which is the group that he's referring to, and the extent to which Bassianus is redefining who the audience is, and what Saturninus spends four lines trying to explain, Bassianus very neatly packages into one, which kind of outdoes his brother immediately, and that's on his speech.
Yeah.
And so it, that parallel construction, and again, they've got the alliteration in the middle, but his other alliteration is better.
Yeah. Where is Saturninus' alliteration?
So patricians, patrons of my right.
Yeah.
It's not pretty close. But yeah, it's like, well, you could do better than that. And the extent to which he's responded to his brother, he can say, of my right, you know, and you can see that he's directly responded to that.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, what you can say.
Same
thing. Right. It's, yeah, go on.
There's something kind of, whereas Saturninus is saying, you know, take up arms, defend and fight, there's something sort of passive in a good way about Bassianus. He's saying, if ever you looked at me in gracious eyes, if you did, I'm not saying you did, but if you did, then help me. And suffer not dishonor to approach. It's dishonor that's approaching, you're just stopping it. You're not, you know, it's not like you have to actually do something, you need to keep things the way they were, and there's something kind of reassuring about that.
Well, you made a very important point about that to me this morning, that there's a difference between the essentially conservative position of Saturninus expressed radically and vice versa.
I think what's, you know, one of the sort of, you know, really dirty rhetorical tricks here, or clever ones depending on whose side you're on, is that Saturninus, politically speaking, is coming from an intensely conservative. I mean, you know, he's actually trying to stick up for the status quo. They've had, I mean, he is technically right here. They've got a system of primogeniture. He should be Caesar, and that's an extremely conservative position, which, I mean, conservative is a boo word in here, I hope, but in ancient Rome, not so much.
Yeah.
And Bassianus, on the other hand, is urging an extremely radical course of action. He's just like, let's overthrow thousands of years of imperial rule and have a democracy. And yet, Saturninus's language makes it sound like defending this conservative position is revolutionary. He's all sort of, to the barricades, there's swords, take arms. Whereas Bassianus is casting this revolutionary political position as if actually it's a defence of continuity. He's saying, keep then this passage to the capital, suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, and then he's talking about the imperial seat as, you know, what it's consecrate to. As it's, you know, he's talking about the history of the office. And so Bassianus essentially is presenting this extremely radical overturning of the established order as a sort of, you know, safe, conservative continuity. And Saturninus is made to sound like a kind of foaming revolutionary.
That's interesting because there's also a sense in which Bassianus does say fight, but only right at the end. And fight for freedom, who's going to dispose?
And your choice.
And your choice, not
yes. Also, it's meant that Saturninus is all in the imperative mood. I mean, it should be very obvious, but it's all in the imperative mood. And as somebody down there just very rightly said, Bassianus is humbly imploring.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying, here's this thing, not me, but this thing, the seat of honour and virtue, which we all have an interest in defending.
And does he thereby sort of appropriate all those virtues to his party? There must be a problem that is a rhetorical phrase for the use of that, but it's as if he, by mentioning his party and his cause being consecrated to virtue, incontinence, and nobility, and all that, it suggests A, that that's his party, but B, that the other side.
I think he's affecting disinterest in a way, isn't he? I mean, he's associating him with it by casting himself as the defender, the disinterested defender of these imperial virtues, and he's essentially saying that it's the office in which the honour is consecrate, whereas of course the, you know, advocate for primogeniture is saying it's my blood in which honour is consecrated.
Yeah.
The diadem. I mean, it's interesting the difference between the seat and the diadem. You know, a diadem is something you kind of bring and plonk on someone's head. Whereas the seat, I mean, of course, might not literally mean a seat,
yeah,
not like a throne, but it's a fixed
yeah,
property,
yeah,
that the sort of emperors come and go, but the seat of virtue, the imperial seat, is fixed. Whereas diadems, obviously, much more mobile, and it's the blood.
An imperial seat also gives a sense that it isn't a throne. That it's sort of just where, you know, the person who's looking after us all sits,
yeah,
and you can have a turn later.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
The post-prone tricolon isn't just a tricolon, it's a rising tricolon, so he adds a syllable each.
Very good.
Each now.
And what do you mean by a rising tricolon? For
so
those of us.
So if it's...
Three stars.
Each one is longer every time it's added. It's,
yeah. So and that just has a greater effect because of the wit involved with it,
yeah,
I guess. Yeah.
I think it's really interesting the extent to which you were suggesting that he was taking a very disinterested position, because it appears to me like Saturninus is sort of automatically dividing up his audience from the very start, not purely in terms of patricians and their people,
But his appeal to the patricians is very much an intellectual one, patrons of right and justice, whereas to countrymen it's my loving followers, superior motive appeal. I think Saturnus loses out in the sense that he's trying to make two sort of simultaneous and distinct appeals, whereas Bassianus is bringing them all together.
It also feels to me as though Saturninus has forgot half the crowd until he actually says the second two lines. Yes, go on.
I was just thinking of what you're saying about like, the words Bassianus uses, like keep, and this kind of continuity. Maybe one of the reasons it's so persuasive is because Bassianus requires you to do so little as a person in the appeal. So it's keep the appeal and suffer not but let. The kind of thing that, and even in fight, it's fight for freedom in your choice. All you have to do is make a choice. Whereas Saturninus is making it sound as if...
You're probably on his side by the time he's got to the word fight, too. That's got one of the keys, isn't it?
Just kind of as a linguistic point, I think where that kind of like humbleness comes from, like if ever Bassianus sees his son were gracious in the eyes of all Rome, that's a subjunctive. So it's deliberate, like it fits into that notion of volition by being in the crowd that he eventually wins you over.
Yes, that he doesn't, he's not, he's absolutely, as Sam was saying, antithetical to the approach of Saturninus saying in the imperative sort of defend, do this. And Bassianus taking the opposite approach. Good. What we're going to do, that's eight lines, or something like eight lines each that we've managed to do this thing. Am I right in thinking these are whiteboards here?
No, can we not. I completely forgotten.
That's all right. Have we got a pen, a felt pen? Mm-hmm. You know that, good. I want you to just come on either side here, and I want you to write it down. I need two people with two pieces of paper, so. Yeah, and each have a pen. Now, you're writing down for Bassianus and you're writing down for Saturninus. I just want to derive from those eight lines each, what do we think, and anybody can answer after you guys. Give me a few characteristics, give me some adjectives that would describe Saturninus now that we've explored the rhetoric. What do we think about his character?
Old.
Old, okay. Older, anyway. Old, okay.
Spoilt.
Egocentric. We're going to do one for Bassianus and one for Saturninus so they can have time to write it down. Bassianus.
Mild.
Clever.
Clever, okay. Mild and clever. Back to Saturninus.
Cold.
He's easier.
Cold.
Authoritative.
Authoritative. Let's go back to Bassianus.
Revolutionary.
Inclusive. Saturninus. He's more fun. He's much fun, isn't he? What do you say? Egocentric. Yeah?
Try hard.
Out of egocentric and out of touch. We're going back over to Bassianus. What about Bassianus?
Underdog.
Underdog.
Humble.
Humble. Very good. That's a matter of opinion, isn't it? Saturninus.
Condescending.
Please.
Overwhelmed
and condescending. Very good. Okay. Anything else? So back to Bassianus.
Sly.
Oh.
In control.
Egalitarian
and sly. Back to Saturninus.
Trying hard.
That's a good adjective.
Desperate.
Shall we try desperate? Yeah. One more for Saturninus.
Honest.
Who said honest? Who said honest? Honest. Okay, honest. I think I'd say paranoiac, actually. Paranoiac, anyway. Yes, come on back to Bassianus. I'm not going to check the spelling, sorry.
Hungry.
Hungry. Mm-hmm. Somebody said?
Manipulative,
yes, you see. Lots of possibilities here. Okay, Saturninus. Anybody got another one for Saturninus?
Plain spoken.
Thank you very much. How sweet of you. I think we're probably all right now, actually. But thank you for trying.
Conservative.
conservative, yes.
Traditional.
Conservative and traditional. Very good. Bassianus.
Progressive.
Eager.
Eager. Yeah. Saturninus.
Violent.
Very good. Anything else on Saturninus?
Petulant.
Petulant. Very good one. Now, any other final ones? We're running out of paper.
Subtle.
Subtle.
Insidious.
Oh, we're dividing our opinion on Bassianus here. Saturninus, final
hawkish.
Thoughts. Hawkish. Hawkish. As in hawk. Hawkish. Any other thoughts on Saturninus?
Patronizing.
I think we have patronizing.
No, I don't think we do.
Condescending. Oh, patronizing. Okay, good. And final thoughts on Bassianus.
Determined,
okay, yes, very good.
Controlled.
And controlled.
Idealistic,
good one, okay.
Intensely controlling.
We'll finish on idealistic, I think. Right, so, now, we're going to read out the list of what we think Saturninus is. Some of these are contradictory, but they're all opinions on the character of Saturninus. Here you go, read them out.
Honest. Desperate, out of touch, paranoid, hawkish, authoritative, violent, condescending, cold, traditional, conservative, egocentric, spoilt, old/older, patronizing, petulant, overwhelmed, and I said honest? Honest.
And honest. Yes, come on then, and Bassianus.
Mild, clever, revolutionary, inclusive, underdog, humble, sly, egalitarian, hungry, manipulative, aggressive, eager, subtle, insidious, determined, and idealistic.
I think for 8 lines of a Shakespeare play, you've derived quite a lot of character traits that you might otherwise have applied, you might have found instinctively, but the exercise really is about deriving from the text what your character might be. Now, some of these are contradictory, some of these are differences of opinion, but let's now do an interesting exercise. Who do you want to play? Do you want to play a hawkish, violent, petulant, traditionalist, conservative, egocentric, spoilt, overwhelmed, paranoiac? Or would you like to play a mild, clever, revolutionary, inclusive underdog who is humble, sly, hungry, progressive, eager, subtle, and insidious? Now, let's cast. Okay, I now want to find... first of all, before you volunteer, I want you to suggest who in this group... This could get very divisive, but I'm sorry, I go after this. Who would be good casting?
Richard Saturninus.
Anybody? We can vote. Anybody else?
Alice.
Okay, we might get 2 goes. All right, so now who are we casting as Bassianus?
Alex.
Richard Saturninus, Alex for Bassianus.
You're Bassianus, okay. All right, okay. All right then, let's... You shift over there as Bassianus' rope. You come here, please. No, actually, you're not going to sit, you're going to stand. No, you're just stand. Yeah. Now, okay, so now you have to take on board, and this is not your own impersonation, this is not your own characterization. This is what we've derived from that. So you have to be all those, you don't have to play them all. But you get the idea of you can play, if you want to take one of them and really run with it, that's fine too. And you're doing the same thing from that point of view. All right, okay. Here is the opening of Titus Andronicus.
Noble patricians, patrons of my right, defend the justice of my cause with arms. And countrymen, my loving foes, plead my successive title with your swords. I am firstborn son that was the last that wore the imperial diadem of Rome. Then let my father's honours live in me, nor wrong mine age with that indignity.
Romans, friends, followers, favourers of my right, if ever Bassianus, Caesar's son, were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome, keep then this passage to the Capitol, and suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, to virtue consecrate to justice, continence, and nobility. But let desert in pure election shine. And, Romans, fight for freedom in your choice.
Very good. I thought that was particularly good casting. Let's have two more. What about the girls? Let's have a bit of 50-50 casting here. So if Saturninus and Bassianus are female characters, who are we casting as Saturninus?
Lucy
Saturninus. I'm getting to know a lot about you. Therefore, who is Bassianus?
Georgiou is Bassianus.
Right, here we go. You have been volunteered. Let's hear your versions. You can play a different characteristic from the list if you choose.
Noble patricians, patrons of my right, defend the justice of my cause with arms. And countrymen, my loving followers, plead my successive title with your swords. I am his firstborn son, that was the last that wear the imperial diadem of Rome. Then let my father's honours live in me, nor wrong my age with this indignity.
Romans! Followers, favourers of my right, if ever Pausanias, Caesar's son, were gracious in the eyes of royal Rome, keep then this passage to the capital, and suffer not dishonour to approach the imperial seat, to virtue consecrated, to justice, continence, and nobility, but let desert in pure election shine. And Romans, fight for the freedom in your choice.
Thank you very much. I thought it was rather interesting, actually. I happened to... For some reason, I didn't believe Bassianus at all that time. I was very suspicious of your rhetoric, isn't that interesting? But that, I guess, is the point of the exercise. Look, we've already rattled on for more than an hour, so we should have an opportunity to open this up to questions.